Side 13, It, by Stephen King, continuing on page 463. It could have been that the gas dripped down to the handles of some of those torches, and when they lit them, why, those holding them panicked and threw them any which way just to get rid of them. Whatever, that black November night was suddenly blazing with torches. Some was holding them up and waving them around, little flaming pieces of burlap falling off in the tops of them. Some of them were laughing. But like I say, some of the others up and threw them through the back windows into what was our kitchen. The place was burning merry hell in a minute and a half. The men outside, they were all wearing their peaky white hoods by then. Some of them were chanting, "Come out, niggers, come out, niggers, come out, niggers." Maybe some of them were chanting to scare us, but I like to believe most of them were trying to warn us, same way as I like to believe that maybe those torches going into the kitchen the way they did was an accident. Either way, it didn't much matter. The band was playing louder than a factory whistle. Everybody was whooping it up and having a good time. Nobody inside knew anything was wrong until Jerry McCrew, who was playing assistant cook that night, opened the door to the kitchen and damn near got blowtorched. Flame shot out 10 feet and burned his mess jacket right off, burned most of his hair off as well. I was sitting about halfway down the east wall with Trev Dawson and Dick Halloran when it happened, and at first I had an idea the gas stove had exploded. I'd no more than got on my feet when I was knocked down by people headed for the door. About 24 of them went marching right up my back, and I guess that was the only time during the whole thing that I really felt scared. I could hear people screaming and telling each other they had to get out. The place was on fire. But every time I tried to get up, someone footed me right back down again. Someone landed his big shoe square in the back of my head, and I saw stars. My nose mashed on that oiled floor, and I snuffled up dirt and began to cough and sneeze at the same time. Someone else stepped on the small of my back. I felt a lady's high heel slam down between the cheeks of my butt, and son, I never want another half-ass enema like that one. If the seat of my khakis had ripped, I believe I'd be bleeding down there to this day. It sounds funny now, but I damn near died in that stampede. I was whopped, whapped, stomped, walked on, and kicked in so many places I couldn't walk tall the next day. I was screaming, and none of those people topside heard me or paid any mind. It was Trev saved me. I seen this big brown hand in front of me, and I grabbed it like a drowning man grabs a life preserver. I grabbed, and he hauled, and up I came. Someone's foot got me in the side of my neck right here.
He massaged that area where the jaw turns up toward the ear, and I nodded.
And it hurt so bad that I guess I blacked out for a minute. But I never let go of Trev's hand, and he never let go of mine. I got to my feet finally, just as the wall we'd put up between the kitchen and the hall fell over. It made a noise like floomp, the noise a puddle of gasoline makes when you light it. I saw it go over in a big bundle of sparks, and I saw the people running to get out of its way as it fell. Some of them made it, some didn't. One of our fellas, I think it might have been Hort Sartoris, was buried under it, and for just one second, I seen his hand underneath all those blazing coals, opening and closing. There was a white girl, surely no more than 20, and the back of her dress went up. She was with a college boy, and I heard her screaming at him, begging him to help her. He took just about 2 swipes at it and then ran away with the others. She stood there screaming as her dress went up on her. It was like hell out where the kitchen had been. The flames were so bright you couldn't look at them. The heat was baking hot, Mikey, roasting hot. You could feel your skin going shiny. You could feel the hairs in your nose getting crispy. "We gotta break out of here," Trev yells and starts to drag me along the wall. "Come on." Then Dick Halloran catches hold of him. He couldn't have been no more than 19, and his eyes were as big as billiard balls. But he kept his head better than we did. He saved our lives. "Not that way," he yells. "This way." And he pointed back toward the bandstand, toward the fire, you know. "You're crazy," Trevor screamed back. He had a big bull voice, but you could barely hear him over the thunder of the fire and the screaming people. "Die if you want to, but me and Willie are getting out." He still had me by the hand, and he started to haul me toward the door again, although there were so many people around it by then you couldn't see it at all. I would have gone with him. I was so shell-shocked I didn't know what end was up. All I knew was that I didn't want to be baked like a human turkey. Dick grabbed Trev by the hair of the head just as hard as he could, and when Trev turned back, Dick slapped his face. I remember seeing Trev's head bounce off the wall and thinking Dick had gone crazy. Then he was hollering in Trev's face. You go that way and you gon' die. They jammed up against that door, nigger. You don't know that, Trev screamed back at him. And then there was this loud bang, like a firecracker. Only what it was the heat-exploding Marty Devereaux's bass drum. The fire was running along the beams overhead and the oil on the floor was catching. I know it, Dick screams back. I know it. He grabbed my other hand, and for a minute there I felt like the rope in a tug-of-war game. Then Trev took a good look at the door and went Dick's way. Dick got us down to a window and grabbed a chair to bust it out. But before he could swing it, the heat blew it out for him. Then he grabbed Trev Dawson by the back of his pants and hauled him up. Climb, he shouts. Climb, motherfucker. And Trev went, head up and tail over the dashboard. He boosted me next, and I went up. I grabbed the sides of the window and hauled. I had a good crop of blisters all over my palms the next day. That wood was already smoking. I come out head first, and if Trev hadn't grabbed me, I might have broke my neck. We turned back around, and it was like something from the worst nightmare you ever had, Mikey. That window was just a yellow blazing square of light. Flames were shooting up through that tin roof in a dozen places. We could hear people screaming inside. I saw two brown hands waving around in front of the fire, Dick's hands. Trev Dawson made me a step with his own hands, and I reached through that window and grabbed Dick. When I took his weight, my gut went against the side of the building, and it was like having your belly against a stove that's just starting to get real good and hot. Dick's face came up, and for a few seconds I didn't think we was going to be able to get him. He'd taken a right smart of smoke, and he was close to passing out. His lips had cracked open, the back of his shirt was smoldering. And then I damn near let go, because I could smell the people burning inside. I've heard people say that smell is like barbecuing pork ribs, but it ain't like that. It's more like what happens sometimes after they geld horses. They build a big fire and throw all that shit into it, and when the fire gets hot enough, you can hear them hoss balls popping like chestnuts, and that's what people smell like when they start to cook right inside their clothes. I could smell that, and I knew I couldn't take it for long, so I gave one more great big yank, and out came Dick. He lost one of his shoes. I tumbled off Trev's hands and went down. Dick come down on top of me, and I'm here to tell you that nigger's head was hard. I lost most of my breath and just laid there in the dirt for a few seconds, rolling around and holding my belly guts. Presently, I was able to get to my knees, then to my feet, and I seen these shapes running off toward the green belt. At first, I thought they were ghosts, and then I seen shoes. By then, it was so bright around the black spot, it was like daylight. I seen shoes and understood it was men wearing sheets. One of them had fallen a little bit behind the others, and I saw... He trailed off, licking his lips. What did you see, Daddy? I asked. Never you mind, he said. Give me my water, Mikey.
I did. He drank most of it, and then got coughing. A passing nurse looked in and said, Do you need anything, Mr. Hanlon?
New set of testins, my dad said. You got any handy, Rhoda?
She smiled a nervous, doubtful smile and passed on. My dad handed the glass to me and I put it back on his table.
It's longer telling than it is remembering, he said. You go and fill that glass up for me before you leave?
Sure, Daddy.
This story go and give you nightmares, Mikey?
I opened my mouth to lie and then thought better of it. And I think now that if I had lied, he would have stopped right there. He was far gone by then, but maybe not that far gone.
I guess so, I said. That's not such a bad thing, he said to me. In nightmares, we can think the worst. That's what they're there for, I guess.
He reached out his hand, and I took it, and we held hands while he finished.
I looked around just in time to see Trev and Dick going around the front of the building, and I chased after them, still trying to catch my wind. There was maybe 40 or 50 people out there, some of them crying, some of them puking, some of them screaming, some of them doing all three things at once, it seemed like. Others were laying on the grass, fainted dead away with the smoke. The door was shut, and we heard people screaming on the other side, screaming to let them out for the love of Jesus, they were burning up. It was the only door, except for the one that went through the kitchen to where the garbage cans and things were, you see. To go in, you pushed the door open. To go out, you had to pull it. Some people had gotten out, and then they started to jam up at that door and push. The door got slammed shut. The ones in the back kept pushing forward to get away from the fire, and everybody got jammed up. The ones right up front were squashed. Wasn't no way they could get that door open against the weight of all those behind. So there they were, trapped, and the fire raged. It was Trev Dawson that made it so it was only 80 or so that died instead of 100 or maybe 200, and what he got for his pains wasn't a medal, but 2 years in the Rye Stockade. See, right about then, this big old cargo truck pulled up, and who should be behind the wheel but my old friend Sergeant Wilson, the fellow who owned all the holes there on the base. He gets out and starts shouting orders that didn't make much sense and which people couldn't hear anyway. Trev grabbed my arm and we run over to him. I lost all track of Dick Halloran by then and didn't even see him until the next day. "Sergeant, I have to use your truck," Trev yells in his face. "Get out of my way, nigger," Wilson says and pushes him down. Then he starts yelling all that confused shit again. Wasn't nobody paying any attention to him, and he didn't go on for long anyway because Trevor Dawson popped up like a jack-in-the-box and decked him. Trev could hit damned hard, and almost any other man would have stayed down, but that cracker had a hard head. He got up, blood pouring out of his mouth and nose, and he said, "I'm going to kill you for that." Well, Trev hit him in the belly just as hard as he could. And when he doubled over, I put my hands together and pounded the back of his neck just as hard as I could. It was a cowardly thing to do, hitting a man from behind like that. But desperate times call for desperate measures. And I would be lying, Mikey, if I didn't tell you that hitting that poor mouth son of a bitch didn't give me a bit of pleasure. Down he went, just like a steer hit with a pole axe. Trev ran to the truck, fired it up, and drove it around so it was facing the front of the black spot, but to the left of the door. He throwed it into first, popped the clutch on that cocksucker, and here he come. "Look out there," I shouted at the crowd of people standing around. "Where that truck?" They scattered like quail, and for a wonder, Trev didn't hit none of them. He hit the side of the building going maybe 30, and cracked his face a good one on the steering wheel of the truck. I seen the blood fly from his nose when he shook his head to clear it. He punched out reverse, backed up 50 yards, and come down on her again. Wham! The black spot wasn't nothing but corrugated tin, and that second hit did her. The whole side of that oven fell in, and the flames come roaring out. How anything could have still been alive in there, I don't know, but there was. People are a lot tougher than you'd believe, Mikey. And if you don't believe it, just take a look at me, sliding off the skin of the world by my fingernails. That place was like a smelting furnace. It was a hell of flames and smoke, but people came running out in a regular torrent. There were so many that Trev didn't even dare back the truck up again for fear he would run over some of them. So he got out and ran back to me, leaving it where it was. We stood there, watching it end. It hadn't been 5 minutes all told, but it felt like forever. The last dozen or so that made it out were on fire. People grabbed him and started to roll him around on the ground, trying to put him out. Looking in, we could see other people trying to come, and we knew they wasn't never going to make it. Trev grabbed my hand, and I grabbed him back twice as hard. We stood there holding hands just like you and me are doing now, Mikey. Him with his nose broken, blood running down his face, and his eyes puffing shut. And we watched them people. They were the real ghosts we saw that night. Nothing but shimmers shaped like men and women in that fire, walking toward the opening Trev had bashed with Sergeant Wilson's truck. Some of them had their arms held out, like they expected someone to save them. The others just walked, but they didn't seem to get nowhere. Their clothes were blazing, their faces were running, and one after another they just toppled over and you didn't see them no more. The last one was a woman. Her dress had burned off her, and there she was in her slip. She was burning like a candle. She seemed to look right at me at the end, and I seen her eyelids was on fire. When she fell down, it was over. The whole place went up in a pillar of fire. By the time the base fire trucks and two more from the Main Street fire station got there, it was already burning itself out. That was the fire at the black spot, Mikey. He drank the last of his water and handed me the glass to fill at the drinking fountain in the hall. "Gone piss the bed tonight, I guess, Mikey." I kissed his cheek and then went out into the hall to fill his glass. When I returned, he was drifting away again, his eyes glassy and contemplative. When I put the glass on the night table, he mumbled a thank you I could barely understand. I looked at the west clocks on his table and saw it was almost 8. Time for me to go home. I leaned over to kiss him goodbye, and instead heard myself whisper, What did you see?
His eyes, which were now slipping shut, barely turned toward the sound of my voice. He might have known it was me, or he might have believed he was hearing the voice of his own thoughts.
Huh? The thing you saw,
I whispered. I didn't want to hear, but I had to hear. I was both hot and cold, my eyes burning, my hands freezing, but I had to hear. As I suppose Lot's wife had to turn back and look at the destruction of Sodom.
'Twas a bird, he said, right over the last of those running men. A hawk, maybe, what they call a kestrel. But it was big. Never told no one. Would have been locked up. That bird was maybe 60 feet from wing tip to wing tip. It was the size of a Japanese Zero. But I seen its eyes, and I think it seen me.
His head slipped over to the side, toward the window, where the dark was coming.
It swooped down and grabbed that last man up. Got him right by the sheet, it did. And I heard that bird's wings. The sound was like fire, and it hovered. And I thought, birds can't hover. But this one could, because...
He fell silent.
Why, Daddy?
I whispered.
Why could it hover? It didn't hover, he said.
I sat there in silence, thinking he had gone to sleep for sure this time. I had never been so afraid in my life, because 4 years before, I had seen that bird. Somehow, in some unimaginable way, I had nearly forgotten that nightmare. It was my father who brought it back.
It didn't hover, he said. It floated. There were big bunches of balloons tied to each wing, and it floated.
My father went to sleep. March 1st, 1985. It's come again. I know that now. I'll wait, but in my heart, I know it. I'm not sure I can stand it. As a kid, I was able to deal with it, but it's different with kids. In some fundamental way, it's different. I wrote all of that last night in a kind of frenzy, not that I could have gone home anyway. Derry has been blanketed in a thick glaze of ice, and although the sun is out this morning, nothing is moving. I wrote until long after 3 this morning, pushing the pen faster and faster, trying to get it all out. I had forgotten about seeing the giant bird when I was 11. It was my father's story that brought it back, and I never forgot it again. Not any of it. In a way, I suppose it was his final gift to me. A terrible gift, you would say, but wonderful in its way. I slept right where I was, my head in my arms, my notebook and pen on the table in front of me. I woke up this morning with a numb ass and an aching back, but feeling free somehow, purged of that old story. And then I saw that I had had company in the night as I slept. The tracks, drying to faint, muddy impressions, led from the front door of the library, which I locked, I always lock it, to the desk where I slept. There were no tracks leading away. Whatever it was, it came to me in the night, left its talisman, and then simply disappeared. Tied to my reading lamp was a single balloon. Filled with helium, it floated in a morning sun ray which slanted in through one of the high windows. On it was a picture of my face. The eyes gone, blood running down from the ragged sockets, a scream distorting the mouth on the balloon's thin and bulging rubber skin. I looked at it and I screamed. The scream echoed through the library, echoing back, vibrating from the circular iron staircase leading to the stacks. The balloon burst with a bang. Part 3. Grown-ups. The descent, made up of despairs and without accomplishment, realizes a new awakening, which is a reversal of despair. For what we cannot accomplish, what is denied to love, what we have lost in the anticipation, a descent follows, endless and indestructible. William Carlos Williams, Patterson. Don't it make you want to go home now? Don't it make you want to go home? Oh, God's children get weary when they roam. Don't it make you want to go home? Don't it make you want to go home? Joe South. Chapter 10. The Reunion. 1. Bill Denbro gets a cab. The telephone was ringing, bringing him up and out of a sleep too deep for dreams. He groped for it without opening his eyes, without coming more than halfway awake. If it had stopped ringing just then, he would have slipped back down into sleep without a hitch. He would have done it as simply and easily as he had once slipped down the snow-covered hills in McCarran Park on his flexible flyer. You ran with the sled, threw yourself onto it, and down you went, seemingly at the speed of sound. You couldn't do that as a grown-up. It racked the hell out of your balls. His fingers walked over the telephone's dial, slipped off, climbed it again. He had a dim premonition that it would be Mike Hanlon. Mike Hanlon calling from Derry, telling him he had to come back, telling him he had to remember, telling him they had made a promise. Stan Uris had cut their palms with a sliver of Coke bottle and they had made a promise. Except all of that had already happened. He had gotten in late yesterday afternoon, just before 6 p.m., actually. He supposed that, if he had been the last call on Mike's list, all of them must have gotten in at varying times. Some might even have spent most of the day here. He himself had seen none of them, felt no urge to see any of them. He had simply checked in, gone up to his room, ordered a meal from room service, which he found he could not eat once it was laid out before him, and then had tumbled into bed and slept dreamlessly until now. Bill cracked one eye open and fumbled for the telephone's handset. It fell off onto the table, and he groped for it, opening his other eye. He felt totally blank inside his head, totally unplugged, running on batteries. He finally managed to scoop up the phone. He got up on one elbow and put it against his ear. Hello? Bill? It was Mike Hanlon's voice. He'd had at least that much right. Last week he didn't remember Mike at all, and now a single word was enough to identify him. It was rather marvelous, but in an ominous way. Yeah, Mike. Woke you up, huh? Yeah, you did. That's okay. On the wall above the TV was an abysmal painting of lobster men in yellow slickers and rain hats pulling lobster traps. Looking at it, Bill remembered where he was. The Derry townhouse on Upper Main Street. Half a mile farther up and across the street was Basie Park, the Kissing Bridge, the canal. What time is it, Mike? 9:45. What day? The 30th. Mike sounded a little amused. Yeah, okay. I've arranged a little reunion, Mike said. He sounded diffident now. Yeah? Bill swung his legs out of bed. They all came? All but Stan Uris, Mike said. Now there was something in his voice that Bill couldn't read. Bev was the last one. She got in late last evening. Why do you say the last one, Mike? Stan might show up today. Bill, Stan's dead. What? How? Did his plane? Nothing like that, Mike said. Look, if it's all the same to you, I think it ought to wait until we get together. It would be better if I could tell all of you at the same time. It has to do with this? Yes, I think so. Mike paused briefly. I'm sure it does. Bill felt the familiar weight of dread settle around his heart again. Was it something you could get used to so quickly then? Or had it been something he had carried all along, simply unfelt and unthought of, like the inevitable fact of his own death? He reached for his cigarettes, lit one, and blew out the match with the first drag. None of them got together yesterday? No, I don't believe so. And you haven't seen any of us yet? No, just talked to you on the phone. Okay, he said. Where's the reunion? You remember where the old ironworks used to be? Past your road, sure. You're behind the times, old chum. That's Mall Road these days. We've got the third biggest shopping mall in the state out there. 48 different merchants under one roof for your shopping convenience. Sounds really American, all right. Bill? What? You all right? Yes, but his heart was beating too fast, the tip of his cigarette jittering a tiny bit. He had stuttered. Mike had heard it. There was a moment of silence, and then Mike said, Just out past the mall, there's a restaurant called Jade of the Orient. They have private rooms for parties. I arranged for one of them yesterday. We can have it the whole afternoon if we want. You think this might take that long? I just don't know. A cab will know how to get there? Sure. All right, Bill said. He wrote the name of the restaurant down on the pad by the phone. Why there? Because it's new, I guess, Mike said slowly. It seemed like... I don't know. Neutral ground, Bill suggested. Yes, I guess that's it. Food any good? I don't know, Mike said. How's your appetite? Bill chuffed out smoke and half laughed, half coughed. It ain't so good, old pal. Yeah, Mike said. I hear you. Noon? More like one, I guess. We'll let Beverly catch a few more Z's. Bill snuffed the cigarette.
She married?
Mike hesitated again. We'll catch up on everything, he said.
Just like when you go back to your old high school reunion 10 years later, huh?
Bill said.
You get to see who got fat, who got bald, who got kids.
I wish it was like that, Mike said.
Yeah, me too, Mikey. Me too.
He hung up the phone, took a long shower, and ordered a breakfast that he didn't want and which he only picked at. No, his appetite was really not much good at all. Bill dialed the big yellow cab company and asked to be picked up at 1:15, thinking that 15 minutes would be plenty of time to get him out to Pasture Road. He found himself totally unable to think of it as Mall Road, even when he actually saw the mall. But he had underestimated the lunch hour traffic flow and how much Derry had grown. In 1958, it had been a big town, not much more. There were maybe 30,000 people inside the Derry Incorporated city limits, and maybe another 7,000 beyond that in the surrounding burgs. Now it had become a city, a very small city by London or New York standards, but doing just fine by Maine standards, where Portland, the state's largest, could boast barely 300,000. As the cab moved slowly down Main Street, we're over the canal now, Bill thought. Can't see it, but it's down there, running in the dark. And then turned up center, his first thought was predictable enough. How much had changed? But the predictable thought was accompanied by a deep dismay that he never would have expected. He remembered his childhood here as a fearful, nervous time, not only because of the summer of 58, when the seven of them had faced the terror, but because of George's death, the deep dream his parents seemed to have fallen into following that death, the constant ragging about his stutter, Bowers and Huggins and Chris constantly on the prod for them after the rock fight in the Barrens. Bowers and Huggins and Chris, oh my, Bowers and Huggins and Chris, oh my. And just a feeling that Derry was cold, that Derry was hard, that Derry didn't much give a shit if any of them lived or died, and certainly not if they triumphed over Pennywise the Clown. Derry folk had lived with Pennywise in all his guises for a long time, and maybe, in some mad way, they had even come to understand him, to like him, need him, love him. Maybe. Yes, maybe that too. So why this dismay? Perhaps only because it seemed such dull change, somehow. Or perhaps because Derry seemed to have lost its essential face for him. The Bijou Theater was gone, replaced with a parking lot, by permit only, the sign over the ramp announced, violators subject to tow. The Shoe Boat and Bailey's Lunch, which had stood next to it, were also gone. They had been replaced by a branch of the Northern National Bank. A digital readout jutted from the front of the bland cinder block structure, showing the time and the temperature, the latter in both degrees Fahrenheit and degrees Celsius. The Center Street drug, lair of Mr. Keene, and the place where Bill had gotten Eddie his asthma medicine that day, was also gone. Richard's Alley had become some strange hybrid called a mini-mall. Looking inside as the cab idled at a stoplight, Bill could see a record shop, a natural food store, and a toys and games shop which was featuring a clearance sale on all Dungeons and Dragons supplies. The cab pulled forward with a jerk. "Gonna take a while," the driver said. "I wish all these goddamn banks would stagger their lunch hours. Pardon my French if you're a religious man." "That's all right," Bill said. It was overcast outside, and now a few splatters of rain hit the cab's windshield. The radio muttered about an escaped mental patient from somewhere who was supposed to be very dangerous, and then began muttering about the Red Sox who weren't. Showers early, then clearing. When Barry Manilow began moaning about Mandy, who came and who gave without taking, the cabbie snapped the radio off. Bill asked,
"When did they go up?"
"What? The banks?"
"Uh-huh."
"Oh, late 60s, early 70s, most of them," the cabbie said. He was a big man with a thick neck. He wore a red and black checked hunter's jacket. A fluorescent orange cap was jammed down squarely on his head. It was smudged with engine oil.
"They got this urban renewal money. Revenue sharing, they call it. So how they shared it was ripped down everything. And the banks come in. I guess that was all that could afford to come in. Hell of a note, ain't it? Urban renewal, says they. Shit for dinner, says I. Pardon my French if you're a religious man. There was a lot of talk about how they was going to revitalize the downtown. Yep, they revitalized it just fine. Tore down most of the old stores and put up a lot of banks and parking lots. And you know, you still can't find a fucking slot to park your car in.
ought to string the whole city council up by their cocks. Except for that Polack woman that's on it. String her up by her tits. On second thought, it don't seem like she's got any. Flat as a fucking board. Pardon my French if you're a religious man. I am, Bill said, grinning. Then get out of my cab and go to fucking church, the cabbie said, and they both burst out laughing. You lived here long? Bill asked. My whole life. Born in Derry Home Hospital, and they'll bury my fucking remains out in Mount Hope Cemetery. Good deal, Bill said. Yeah, right, the cabbie said. He hawked, rolled down his window, and spat an extremely large yellow-green lunger into the rainy air. His attitude, contradictory but somehow attractive, almost piquant, was one of glum good cheer. Guy who catches that won't have to buy no fucking chewing gum for a week. Pardon my French if you're a religious man. It hasn't all changed, Bill said. The depressing promenade of banks and parking lots was slipping behind them as they climbed Center Street. Over the hill and past the First National, they began to pick up some speed. The Aladdin's still there. Yeah, the cabbie conceded, but just barely. Suckers tried to tear that down, too. For another bank? Bill asked, a part of him amused to find that another part of him stood aghast at the idea. He couldn't believe that anyone in his right mind would want to tear down that stately pleasure dome with its glittering glass chandelier, its sweeping right and left staircases, which spiraled up to the balcony, and its mammoth curtain, which did not simply pull apart when the show started, but which instead rose in magical folds and tucks and gathers, all underlit in fabulous shades of red and blue and yellow and green, while pulleys off stage ratcheted and groaned. Not the Aladdin. That shocked part of him cried out. How could they ever think of tearing down the Aladdin for a bank? Oh, a bank, the cabbie said. You're fucking a... Pardon my French if you're a religious man. It was the First Merchants of Penobscot County had its eye on the Aladdin. Wanted to pull it down and put up what they called a complete banking mall. Got all the papers from the city council and the Aladdin was condemned. Then a bunch of folks formed a committee, folks that had lived here a long time. And they petitioned, and they marched, and they hollered, and finally they had a public city council meeting about it, and Hanlon blew those suckers out. The cabbie sounded extremely satisfied. Hanlon? Bill asked, startled. Mike Hanlon? Yep, the cabbie said. He twisted around briefly to look at Bill, revealing a round, chapped face and horn-rimmed glasses with old specks of white paint on the bows. Librarian, black fella. You know him? I did. Bill said, remembering how he had met Mike back in July 1958. It had been Bowers and Huggins and Chris again. Of course, Bowers and Huggins and Chris. Oh, my. At every turn, playing their own part, unwinning vice grips driving the seven of them together, tight, tighter, tightest. We played together when we were kids, before I moved away. Well, there you go, the cabbie said. It's a small fucking world. Pardon my French if you're a religious man. Bill finished with him. There you go, the cabbie repeated comfortably, and they rode in silence for a while before he said, It's changed a lot, Derry has, but yeah, a lot of it's still here. The townhouse where I picked you up, the standpipe and Memorial Park. You remember that place, mister? When we were kids, we used to think that place was haunted. I remember it, Bill said. Look, there's the hospital. You recognize it? They were passing the Derry Home Hospital on the right now. Behind it, the Penobscot flowed toward its meeting place with the Kanduskeag. Under the rainy spring sky, the river was dull pewter. The hospital that Bill remembered, a white wood frame building with two wings, three stories high, was still there. But now it was surrounded, dwarfed, by a whole complex of buildings, maybe a dozen in all. He could see a parking lot off to the left, and what looked like better than 500 cars parked there. My God, that's not a hospital, that's a fucking college campus, Bill exclaimed. The cab driver cackled. Not being a religious man, I'll pardon your French. Yeah, it's almost as big as the Eastern Maine up in Bangor now. They got radiation labs and a therapy center and 600 rooms and their own laundry and God knows what else. The old hospital's still there, but it's all administration now. Bill felt a queer doubling sensation in his mind, the sort of sensation he remembered getting the first time he watched a 3D movie. Trying to bring together two images that didn't quite jibe. You could fool your eyes and your brain into doing that trick, he remembered, but you were apt to end up with a whopper of a headache. And he could feel his own headache coming on now. New Derry, fine. But the old dairy was still here, like the wooden home hospital building. The old dairy was mostly buried under all the new construction, but your eye was somehow dragged helplessly back to look at it, to look for it. "The train yard's probably gone, isn't it?" Bill asked. The cabbie laughed again, delighted. "For someone who moved away when he was just a kid, you got a good memory, mister," Bill thought. "You should have met me last week, my French-speaking friend. It's all still out there, but it's nothing but ruins and rusty tracks now. The freights don't even stop no more. Fellow wanted to buy the land and put up a whole roadside entertainment thing. Pitch and putt, batting cages, driving ranges, mini-golf, go-karts, little shack full of video games. I don't know what all. But there's some kind of big mix-up about who owns the land now. I guess he'll get it eventually. He's a persistent fella. But right now it's in the courts." "And the canal," Bill murmured as they turned off Outer Center Street and onto Pasture Road, which, as Mike had said, was now marked with a green road sign reading Mall Road. "The canal's still here." "Yep," the cabbie said. "That'll always be here, I guess." Now the Dairy Mall was on Bill's left, and as they rolled past it, he felt that queer doubling sensation again. When they had been kids, all of this had been a great long field full of rank grasses and gigantic nodding sunflowers, which marked the northeastern end of the Barrens. Behind it, to the west, was the old Cape low-income housing development. He could remember them exploring this field, being careful not to fall into the gaping cellar hold of the Kitchener Ironworks, which had exploded on Easter Sunday in the year 1906. The field had been full of relics, and they had unearthed them with all the solemn interest of archaeologists exploring Egyptian ruins. Bricks, dippers, chunks of iron with rusty bolts hanging from them, panes of glass, bottles full of unnameable gunk that smelled like the worst poison in the world. Something bad had happened near here, too, in the gravel pit close to the dump, but he could not yet remember it. He could only remember a name, Patrick Humboldt, and that it had something to do with the refrigerator, and something about a bird that had chased Mike Hanlon. What? He shook his head. Fragments, straws in the wind, that was all. The field was gone now, as were the remains of the ironworks. Bill remembered the great chimney of the ironworks suddenly. Faced with tile, caked black with soot for the final 10 feet of its length, it had lain in the high grass like a gigantic pipe. They had scrambled up somehow and had walked along it, arms held out like tight wire walkers, laughing. He shook his head, as if to dismiss the mirage of the mall, an ugly collection of buildings with signs that said Sears and J.C. Penney and Woolworths and CVS and York Steakhouse and Walden Books and dozens of others. Roads wove in and out of parking lots. The mall did not go away, because it was no mirage. The Kitchener Ironworks was gone, and the field that had grown up around its ruins was likewise gone. The mall was the reality, not the memories. But somehow he didn't believe that. "Here you go, mister," the cabbie said. He pulled into the parking lot of a building that looked like a large plastic pagoda. "A little late, but better late than never, am I right?" "Indeed you are," Bill said. He gave the cab driver a five. "Keep the change." "Good fucking deal," the cabbie exclaimed. "You need someone to drive, call Big Yellow and ask for Dave. Ask for me by name." "I'll just ask for the religious fella," Bill said, grinning. "The one who's got his plot all picked out in Mount Hope." "You got it," Dave said, laughing. "Have a good one, mister." "You too, Dave." He stood in the light rain for a moment, watching the cab draw away. He realized that he had meant to ask the driver one more question and had forgotten, perhaps on purpose. He had meant to ask Dave if he liked living in Derry. Abruptly, Bill Dendro turned and walked into the Jade of the Orient. Mike Hanlon was in the lobby, sitting in a wicker chair with a huge flaring back. He got to his feet, and Bill felt deep unreality wash over him, through him. That sensation of doubling was back, but now it was much, much worse. He remembered a boy who had been about 5'3", trim and agile. Before him was a man who stood about 5'7". He was skinny. His clothes seemed to hang on him, and the lines in his face said that he was on the darker side of 40 instead of only 38 or so. Bill's shock must have shown on his face because Mike said quietly, "I know how I look." Bill flushed and said, "It's not that bad, Mike. It's just that I remember you as a kid. That's all it is." "Is it?" "You look a little tired." I am a little tired, Mike said, but I'll make it, I guess. He smiled then, and the smile lit his face. In it, Bill saw the boy he had known 27 years ago. As the old wood-frame home hospital had been overwhelmed with modern glass and cinder block, so had the boy that Bill had known been overwhelmed with the inevitable accessories of adulthood. There were wrinkles on his forehead, lines had grooved themselves from the corners of his mouth nearly to his chin, and his hair was graying on both sides above the ears. But as the old hospital, although overwhelmed, was still there, still visible, so was the boy Bill had known. Mike stuck out his hand and said, "Welcome back to Derry, Big Bill." Bill ignored the hand and embraced Mike. Mike hugged him back fiercely, and Bill could feel his hair, stiff and kinky, against his own shoulder and the side of his neck. "Whatever's wrong, Mike, we'll take care of it," Bill said. He heard the rough sound of tears in his throat and didn't care. "We beat it once, and we can beat it again." Mike pulled away from him, held him at arm's length. Although he was still smiling, there was too much sparkle in his eyes. He took out his handkerchief and wiped them. "Sure, Bill," he said. "You bet." "Would you gentlemen like to follow me?" the hostess asked. She was a smiling Oriental woman in a delicate pink kimono upon which a dragon cavorted and curled its plaited tail. Her dark hair was piled high on her head and held with ivory combs. "I know the way, Rose," Mike said.
"Very good, Mr. Hanlon." She smiled at both of them. "You are well met in friendship, I think."
"I think we are," Mike said. "This way, Bill." He led him down a dim corridor, past the main dining room, and toward a door where a beaded curtain hung.
"The others," Bill began.
"All here now," Mike said.
"All that could come."
Bill hesitated for a moment outside the door, suddenly frightened. It was not the unknown that scared him, not the supernatural. It was the simple knowledge that he was 15 inches taller than he had been in 1958 and minus most of his hair. He was suddenly uneasy, almost terrified, at the thought of seeing them all again, their children's faces almost worn away, almost buried under change as the old hospital had been buried. Banks erected inside their heads where once magic picture palaces had stood.
"We grew up," he thought. "We didn't think it would happen. Not then, not to us. But it did. And if I go in there, it will be real. We're all grown-ups now."
He looked at Mike, suddenly bewildered and timid.
"How do they look?" he heard himself asking in a faltering voice. "Mike, how do they look?"
"Come in and find out," Mike said, kindly enough, and led Bill into the small private room. 2. Bill Denbrow gets a look. Perhaps it was simply the dimness of the room that caused the illusion, which lasted for only the briefest moment, but Bill wondered later if it wasn't some sort of message meant strictly for him, that fate could also be kind. In that brief moment, it seemed to him that none of them had grown up, that his friends had somehow done a Peter Pan act and were all still children. Richie Tozier was rocked back in his chair so that he was leaning against the wall, caught in the act of saying something to Beverly Marsh, who had a hand cupped over her mouth to hide a giggle. Richie had a wise-ass grin on his face that was perfectly familiar. There was Eddie Kasprak, sitting on Beverly's left, and in front of him on the table, next to the water glass, was a plastic squeeze bottle with a pistol grip handle curving down from its top. The trimmings were a little more state-of-the-art, but the purpose was obviously the same. It was an aspirator. Sitting on one end of the table, watching this trio with an expression of mixed anxiety, amusement, and concentration, was Ben Hanscom. Bill found his hand wanting to go to his head and realized with a sorry kind of amusement that in that second he had almost rubbed his pate to see if his hair had magically come back. That red, fine hair that he had begun to lose when he was only a college sophomore. That broke the bubble. Richie was not wearing glasses, he saw, and thought, "He probably has contacts now. He would. He hated those glasses." The t-shirts and cord pants he'd habitually worn had been replaced by a suit that hadn't been purchased off any rack. Bill estimated that he was looking at $900 worth of tailor-made on the hoof. Beverly Marsh, if her name still was Marsh, had become a stunningly beautiful woman. Instead of the casual ponytail, her hair, which was almost exactly the same shade his own had been, spilled over the shoulders of her plain white ship-and-shore blouse in a torrent of subdued color. In this dim light, it merely glowed like a well-banked bed of embers.
In daylight, even the light of such a subdued day as this one, Bill imagined it would flame. And he found himself wondering what it would feel like to plunge his hands into that hair. The world's oldest story, he thought wryly. I love my wife, but oh, you kid. Eddie, it was weird but true, had grown up to look quite a little bit like Anthony Perkins. His face was prematurely lined, although in his movements he seemed somehow younger than either Richie or Ben, and made older still by the rimless spectacles he wore. Spectacles you would imagine a British barrister wearing as he approached the bench or leafed through a legal brief. His hair was short, worn in an out-of-date style that had been known as Ivy League in the late 50s and early 60s. He was wearing a loud-checked sport coat that looked like something grabbed from the distress sale rack of a men's clothing store that would shortly be out of business. But the watch on one wrist was a Patek Philippe, and the ring on the little finger of his right hand was a ruby. The stone was too hugely vulgar and too ostentatious to be anything but real. Ben was the one who had really changed, and, looking at him again, Bill felt unreality wash easily over him. His face was the same, and his hair, although graying and longer, was combed in the same unusual right side part. But Ben had gotten thin. He sat easily enough in his chair, his unadorned leather vest open to show the blue chambray work shirt beneath. He wore Levi's with straight legs, cowboy boots, and a wide belt with a beaten silver buckle. These clothes hung easily to a body which was slim and narrow-hipped. He wore a bracelet with heavy links on one wrist. Not gold links, but copper ones. He got thin, Bill thought. He's a shadow of his former self, so to speak. Old Ben got thin. Wonders never cease. There was a moment of silence among the six of them that was beyond description. It was one of the strangest moments Bill Denbrough ever passed in his life. Stan was not here, but a seventh had come, nonetheless. Here in this private restaurant dining room, Bill felt its presence so fully that it was almost personified. But not as an old man in a white robe with a scythe on his shoulder. It was the white spot on the map which lay between 1958 and 1985, an area an explorer might have called the Great Don't Know. Bill wondered what exactly was there. Beverly Marsh in a short skirt which showed most of her long, coltish legs, a Beverly Marsh in white go-go boots, her hair parted in the middle and ironed. Richie Tozier carrying a sign which said, Stop the War on one side and get ROTC off campus on the other. Ben Hanscom in a yellow hard hat with a flag decal on the front, running a bulldozer under a canvas parasol, his shirt off, showing a stomach which protruded less and less over the waistband of his pants. Was this seventh creature black? No relation to either H. Rapp Brown or Grandmaster Flash, not this fellow. This fellow wore plain white shirts and fade into the woodwork J.C. Penney slacks, and he sat in a library corral at the University of Maine, writing papers on the origin of footnotes and the possible advantages of ISBN numbers in book cataloging, while the marchers marched outside and Phil Oakes sang, Richard Nixon, find yourself another country to be part of, and men died with their stomachs blown out for villages whose names they could not pronounce. He sat there studiously bent over his work. Bill saw him, which lay in a slant of crisp white winter light, his face sober and absorbed, knowing that to be a librarian was to come as close as any human being can to sitting in the peak seat of eternity's engine. Was he the seventh? Or was it a young man standing before his mirror, looking at the way his forehead was growing, looking at a comb full of pulled-out red hairs, looking at a pile of university notebooks on the desk reflected in the mirror, notebooks which held the completed, messy first draft of a novel entitled Joanna, which would be published a year later? Some of the above, all of the above, none of the above. It didn't matter, really. The seventh was there, and in that one moment they all felt it, and perhaps understood best the dreadful power of the thing that had brought them back. It lives, Bill thought, cold inside his clothes. Eye of Newt, tail of dragon, hand of glory. Whatever it was, it's here again, in Derry. It. And he felt suddenly that it was the seventh, that it and time were somehow interchangeable, that it wore all their faces as well as the thousand others with which it had terrified and killed. And the idea that it might be them was somehow the most frightening idea of all. How much of us was left behind here, he thought with sudden rising terror. How much of us never left the drains and the sewers where it lived and where it fed? Is that why we forgot? Because part of each of us never had any future, never grew, never left Derry? Is that why? He saw no answers on their faces, only his own questions reflected back at him. Thoughts form and pass in a matter of seconds or milliseconds and create their own time frames, and all of this passed through Bill Denbrough's mind in a space of no more than 5 seconds. Then Richie Tozier leaned back against the wall, grinned again, and said, "Oh my, look at this. Bill Denbrough went for the chrome dome look. How long you been turtle-waxing your head, Big Bill?" And Bill, with no idea at all of what might come out, opened his mouth and heard himself say, "Fuck you and the horse you rode in on, trash mouth." There was a moment of silence, and then the room exploded with laughter. Bill crossed to them and began to shake hands, and while there was something horrible in what he now felt, there was also something comforting about it, the sensation of having come home for good. 3. Ben Hanscom gets skinny. Mike Hanlon ordered drinks, and as if to make up for the prior silence, everyone began to talk at once. Beverly Marsh was now Beverly Rogan, it turned out. She said she was married to a wonderful man in Chicago who had turned her whole life around and who had, by some benign magic, been able to transform his wife's simple talent for sewing into a successful dress business. Eddie Casbrack owned a limousine company in New York. "For all I know, my wife could be in bed with Al Pacino right now," he said, smiling mildly, and the room broke up. They all knew what Bill and Ben had been up to, but Bill had a peculiar sense that there had been no personal association of their names. Ben as an architect, himself as a writer, with people they had known as children until very, very recently. Beverly had paperback copies of Joanna and the Black Rapids in her purse and asked him if he would sign them. Bill did so, noticing as he did that both books were in mint condition, as if they had been purchased in the airport newsstand as she got off the plane. In like fashion, Richie told Ben how much he had admired the BBC Communications Center in London, but there was a puzzled sort of light in his eyes, as if he could not quite reconcile that building with this man, or with the fat, earnest boy who had showed them how to flood out half the barrens with scrounged boards and a rusty car door. Richie was a disc jockey in California. He told them he was known as the man of 1,000 voices, and Bill groaned, "God, Richie, your voices were always so terrible." "Flattery will get you nowhere, master," Richie replied loftily. When Beverly asked him if he wore contacts now, Richie said in a low voice, "Come a little closer, baby. Look in my eyes." Beverly did and exclaimed delightedly as Richie tilted his head a little so she could see the lower rims of the Hydromist soft lenses he wore. "Is the library still the same?" Ben asked Mike Hanlon. Mike took out his wallet and produced a snap of the library taken from above. He did it with the proud air of a man producing snapshots of his kids when asked about his family. "Guy in a light plane took this," he said, as the picture went from hand to hand. "I've been trying to get either the city council or some well-heeled private donor to supply enough cash to get it blown up to mural size for the children's library. So far, no soap. But it's a good picture, huh?" They all agreed that it was. Ben held it longest, looking at it fixedly. Finally, he tapped the glass corridor which connected the two buildings. "Do you recognize this from anywhere else, Mike?" Mike smiled. "It's your communications center," he said, and all 6 of them burst out laughing. The drinks came, they sat down. That silence, sudden, awkward, and perplexing, fell again. They looked at each other. "Well," Beverly asked in her sweet, slightly husky voice, "what do we drink to?" "To us," Richie said suddenly, and now he wasn't smiling. His eyes caught Bill's, and with a force so great he could barely deal with it, Bill remembered himself and Richie in the middle of Niebolt Street, after the thing which might have been a clown or which might have been a werewolf had disappeared, embracing each other and weeping. When he picked up his glass, his hand was trembling, and some of his drink spilled on the napery. Richie rose slowly to his feet, and one by one the others followed suit. Bill first, then Ben and Eddie, Beverly, and finally Mike Hanlon. "To us," Richie said, and like Bill's hand, his voice trembled a little. "To the Losers Club of 1958. "The Losers," Beverly said, slightly amused. "The Losers," Eddie said. His face was pale and old behind his rimless glasses. "The Losers," Ben agreed, a faint and painful smile ghosted at the corners of his mouth. "The Losers," Mike Hanlon said softly. The losers, Bill finished. Their glasses touched, they drank. That silence fell again, and this time Richie did not break it. This time the silence seemed necessary. They sat back down, and Bill said, "So spill it, Mike. Tell us what's been happening here and what we can do." "Eat first," Mike said. "We'll talk afterward." So they ate, and they ate long and well. Like that old joke about the condemned man, Bill thought, but his own appetite was better than it had been in ages. Since he was a kid, he was tempted to think. The food was not stunningly good, but it was far from bad, and there was a lot of it. The six of them began trading stuff back and forth. Spare ribs, mugu gai pan, chicken wings that had been delicately braised, egg rolls, water chestnuts wrapped in bacon, strips of beef that had been threaded on wooden skewers. They began with poo-poo platters, and Richie made a childish but amusing business of broiling a little bit of everything over the flaming pot in the center of the platter he was sharing with Beverly, including half an egg roll and a few red kidney beans. "Flambé at my table. I love it," he told Ben. "I'd eat shit on a shingle if it was flambé at my table." "And probably has," Bill remarked. Beverly laughed so hard at this she had to spit a mouthful of food into her napkin.
"Oh, God, I think I'm gonna Ralph,"
Richie said in an eerily exact imitation of Don Pardo, and Beverly laughed harder, blushing a bright red. "Stop it, Richie," she said. "I'm warning you." "The warning is taken," Richie said. "Eat well, dear." Rose herself brought them their dessert, a great mound of baked Alaska which she ignited at the head of the table where Mike sat. "More flambé at my table," Richie said in the voice of a man who has died and gone to heaven. "This may be the best meal I've ever eaten in my life." "But of course," Rose said demurely. "If I blow that out, do I get my wish?" he asked her. "At Jade of the Orient, all wishes are granted, sir." Richie's smile faltered suddenly. "I applaud the sentiment," he said, "but you know, I really doubt the veracity." They almost demolished the baked Alaska. As Bill sat back, his belly straining the waistband of his pants, he happened to notice the glasses on the table. There seemed to be hundreds of them. He grinned a little, realizing that he himself had sunk two martinis before the meal, and God knew how many bottles of Kirin beer with it. The others had done about as well. In their state, fried chunks of bowling pin would probably have tasted okay. And yet he didn't feel drunk. "I haven't eaten like that since I was a kid," Ben said. They looked at him, and a faint flush of color tinged his cheeks. "I mean it, literally. That may be the biggest meal I've eaten since I was a sophomore in high school." "You went on a diet?" Eddie asked. "Yeah," Ben said, "I did. The Ben Hanscom Freedom Diet." "What got you going?" Richie asked. "You don't want to hear all that ancient history?" Ben shifted uncomfortably. "I don't know about the rest of them," Bill said, "but I do. Come on, Ben, give. What turned Haystack Calhoun into the magazine model we see before us today?" Richie snorted a little. "Haystack, right. I'd forgotten that." "It's not much of a story," Ben said. "No story at all, really. After that summer, after 1958, we stayed in Derry another 2 years. Then my mom lost her job and we ended up moving to Nebraska because she had a sister there who offered to take us in until my mother got on her feet again. It wasn't so great. Her sister, my Aunt Jean, was a miserly bitch who had to keep telling you what your place in the great scheme of things was. How lucky we were that my mom had a sister who could give us charity. How lucky we were not to be on welfare. All that sort of thing. I was so fat I disgusted her. She couldn't leave it alone. Ben, you ought to get more exercise. Ben, you'll have a heart attack before you're 40 if you don't lose weight. Ben, with little children starving in the world, you ought to be ashamed of yourself." He paused for a moment and sipped some water. "The thing was, she also trotted the starving children out if I didn't clean my plate." Richie laughed and nodded. "Anyway, the country was just pulling out of a recession and my mother was almost a year finding steady work. By the time we moved out of Aunt Jean's place in La Vista and got our own in Omaha, I'd put on about 90 pounds over when you guys knew me. I think I put on most of it just to spite my Aunt Jean." Eddie whistled. "That would have put you at about... 210, Ben said gravely. "Anyway, I was going to Eastside High School in Omaha, and the phys ed periods were, well, pretty bad. The other kids called me Jugs. That ought to give you the idea. The ragging went on for about 7 months, and then one day, while we were getting dressed in the locker room after the period, two or three of the guys started to kind of slap my gut. They called it fat paddling. Pretty soon, two or three others got in on it. Then four or five more. Pretty soon, it was all of them, chasing me around the locker room and up the hall, whacking my gut, my butt, my back, my legs. I got scared and started to scream. That made the rest of them laugh like crazy. "You know," he said, looking down and carefully rearranging his silverware, "that's the last time I can remember thinking of Henry Bowers until Mike called me 2 days ago. The kid who started it was a farm boy with these big old hands, and while they were chasing after me, I remember thinking that Henry had come back. I know. That's when I panicked. They chased me up the hall past the lockers where the guys who played sports kept their stuff. I was naked and red as a lobster. I'd lost any sense of dignity or of myself, I guess you'd say. Where myself was. I was screaming for help. And here they came after me screaming, fat paddling, fat paddling, fat paddling. There was a bench. Ben, you don't have to put yourself through this, Beverly said suddenly. Her face had gone ashy pale. She toyed with her water glass and almost spilled it. Let him finish, Bill said. Ben looked at him for a moment and then nodded. There was a bench at the end of the corridor. I fell over it and hit my head. They were all around me in another minute or two, and then this voice said, okay, that's enough. You guys go change up. It was Coach, standing there in the doorway, wearing his blue sweatpants with the white stripe up the sides and his white T-shirt. There was no way of telling how long he'd been standing there. They all looked at him, some of them grinning, some of them guilty, some of them just looking sort of vacant. They went away, and I burst into tears. Coach just stood there in the doorway, leaning back to the gym, watching me, watching this naked fat boy with his skin all red from the fat paddling, watching this fat kid crying on the floor. And finally he said, Benny, why don't you just fucking shut up? It shocked me so much to hear a teacher use that word that I did. I looked up at him, and he came over and sat down on the bench I'd fallen over. He leaned over me, and the whistle around his neck swung out and bonked me on the forehead. For a second, I thought he was going to kiss me or something, and I shrank back from him. But what he did was grab one of my tits in each hand and squeeze. Then he took his hands away and rubbed them on his pants like he'd touched something dirty. You think I'm going to comfort you? He asked me. I'm not. You disgust them, and you disgust me as well. We got different reasons, but that's because they're kids and I'm not. They don't know why you disgust them. I do know. It's because I see you burying the good body God gave you in a great big mess of fat. It's a lot of stupid self-indulgence, and it makes me want to puke. Now listen to me, Benny, because this is the only time I'm going to say it to you. I got a football team to coach, and basketball, and track, and somewhere in between I've got swimming team. So I'll just say it once. You're fat up here. And he tapped my forehead right where his damned whistle had bonked me. That's where everybody's fat. You put what's between your ears on a diet, and you're going to lose weight. But guys like you never do. What a bastard, Beverly said indignantly. Yeah, Ben said, grinning. But he didn't know he was a bastard. That's how dumb he was. He'd probably seen Jack Webb in that movie The D.I. about 60 times, and he actually thought he was doing me a favor. And as it turned out, he was, because I thought of something right then. I thought... He looked away, frowning, and Bill had the strangest feeling that he knew what Ben was going to say before he said it. I told you that the last time I can remember thinking of Henry Bowers was when the other boys were chasing after me and fat paddling. Well, when the coach was getting up to go, that was the last time I really thought of what we'd done in the summer of 58. I thought... He hesitated again, looking at each of them in turn, seeming to search their faces. He went on carefully. I thought of how good we were together. I thought of what we did and how we did it. And all at once it hit me that if Coach had to face anything like that, his hair would probably have turned white all at once and his heart would have stopped dead in his chest like an old watch. It wasn't fair, of course, but he hadn't been fair to me. What happened was simple enough. You got mad, Bill said. Ben smiled. Yeah, that's right, he said. I called Coach. He turned around and looked at me. You say you coach track? I asked him. That's right, he said. Not that it's anything to you. You listen to me, you stupid stone-brained son of a bitch, I said, and his mouth dropped open and his eyes bugged out. I'll be out there for the track team in March. What do you think about that? I think you better shut your mouth before it gets you into big trouble, he said. I'm going to run down everyone you get out, I said. I'm going to run down your best, and then I want a fucking apology from you. His fist clenched, and for a minute I thought he was going to come back in there and let me have it. Then they unclenched again. You just keep talking, fat boy, he said softly. You got the motor mouth. But the day you can outrun my best will be the day I quit this place and go back to picking corn on the circuit. And he left. You lost the weight? Richie asked. Well, I did, Ben said. But Coach was wrong. It didn't start in my head. It started with my mother. I went home that night and told her I wanted to lose some weight. We ended up having a hell of a fight, both of us crying. She started out with that same old song and dance. I wasn't really fat. I just had big bones. And a big boy who was going to be a big man had to eat big just to stay even. It was a kind of security thing with her, I think. It was scary for her, trying to raise a boy on her own. She had no education and no real skills, just a willingness to work hard. And when she could give me a second helping, or when she could look across the table at me and see that I was looking solid, she felt like she was winning the battle, Mike said. Uh-huh. Ben drank off the last of his beer and wiped a small mustache of foam off his upper lip with the heel of his hand. So the biggest fight wasn't with my head, it was with her. She just wouldn't accept it, not for months. She wouldn't take in my clothes, and she wouldn't buy me new ones. I was running by then. I ran everywhere, and sometimes my heart pounded so hard I felt like I was going to pass out. The first of my mile runs I finished by puking and then fainting. Then for a while I just puked, and after a while I was holding my pants while I ran. I got a paper route and ran with the bag around my neck, bouncing against my chest, while I held up my pants. My shirt started to look like sails. And nights when I went home and would only eat half the stuff on my plate, my mother would burst into tears and say that I was starving myself, killing myself, that I didn't love her anymore, that I didn't care about how hard she had worked for me. Christ, Richie muttered, lighting a cigarette. I don't know how you handled it, Ben. I just kept the coach's face in front of me, Ben said. I just kept remembering the way he looked after he grabbed my tits in the hallway to the boys' locker room that time. That's how I did it. I got myself some new jeans and stuff with the paper route money, and the old guy in the first floor apartment used his awl to punch some new holes in my belt. About 5 of them, as I remember. I think I might have remembered the other time I had to buy a pair of new jeans. That was when Henry pushed me into the barrens that day, and they just about got torn off my body. Yeah, Eddie said, grinning. And you told me about the chocolate milk. Remember that? Ben nodded. If I did remember, he went on, it was just for a second, there and gone. About that same time, I started taking health and nutrition at school, and I found out you could eat just about all the raw green stuff you wanted and not gain weight. So one night my mother put on a salad with lettuce and raw spinach in it, chunks of apple, and maybe a little leftover ham. Now, I've never liked rabbit food that much, but I had 3 helpings and just raved on and on to my mother about how good it was. That went a long way toward solving the problem. She didn't care so much what I ate as long as I ate a lot of it. She buried me in salads. I ate them for the next 3 years. There were times when I had to look in the mirror to make sure my nose wasn't wriggling. So what happened about the coach? Eddie asked. Did you go out for track? He touched his aspirator as if the thought of running had reminded him of it. Oh yeah, I went out, Ben said. The 220 and the 440. By then I'd lost 70 pounds, and I'd sprung up 2 inches so that what was left was better distributed. On the first day of trials, I won the 220 by 6 lengths and the 440 by 8. Then I went over to Coach, who looked mad enough to chew nails and spit out staples, and I said, "Looks like it's time you got out on the circuit and started picking corn. When are you heading down Kansas way?" He didn't say a thing at first, just swung a roundhouse and knocked me flat on my back. Then he told me to get off the field. Said he didn't want a smart-mouthed bastard like me on his track team. I wouldn't be on it if President Kennedy appointed me to it, I said, wiping blood out of the corner of my mouth. And since you got me going, I won't hold you to it. But the next time you sit down to a big plate of corn on the cob, spare me a thought. He told me if I didn't get out right then, he was going to beat the living crap out of me. Ben was smiling a little, but there was nothing pleasant about that smile. Certainly nothing nostalgic. Those were his exact words. Everyone was watching us, including the kids I'd beaten. They looked pretty embarrassed. So I just said, "I'll tell you what, Coach. You get one free, on account of you're a sore loser but too old to learn any better now. But you put one more on me, and I'll try to see to it that you lose your job. I'm not sure I can do it, but I can make a good try. I lost the weight so I could have a little dignity and a little peace. Those are things worth fighting for." Bill said, "All of that sounds wonderful, Ben, but the writer in me wonders if any kid ever really talked like that." Ben nodded, still smiling that peculiar smile. "I doubt if any kid who hadn't been through the things we went through ever did," he said. "But I said them, and I meant them." Bill thought about this and then nodded. "All right." The coach stood back with his hands on the hips of his sweatpants, Ben said. He opened his mouth, and then he closed it again. Nobody said anything. I walked off, and that was the last I had to do with Coach Woodley. When my homeroom teacher handed me my course sheet for my junior year, someone had typed the word "excused" next to phys ed, and he'd initialed it. "You beat him," Richie exclaimed and shook his clenched hands over his head. "Way to go, Ben." Ben shrugged. "I think what I did was beat part of myself. Coach got me going, I guess. But it was thinking of you guys that made me really believe that I could do it. And I did do it." Ben shrugged charmingly, but Bill believed he could see fine drops of sweat at his hairline. End of true confessions. Except I sure could use another beer. Talking's thirsty work. Mike signaled the waitress. All six of them ended up ordering another round, and they talked of light matters until the drinks came. Bill looked into his beer, watching the way the bubbles crawled up the sides of the glass. He was both amused and appalled to realize he was hoping someone else would begin to story about the years between. That Beverly would tell them about the wonderful man she had married, even if he was boring, as most wonderful men were. Or that Richie Tozier would begin to expound on funny incidents in the broadcasting studio. Or that Eddie Kasprak would tell them what Teddy Kennedy was really like, how much Robert Redford tipped. Or maybe offer some insights into why Ben had been able to give up the extra pounds while he needed to hang on to his aspirator. The fact is, Bill thought, Mike is going to start talking any minute now, and I'm not sure I want to hear what he has to say. The fact is, my heart is beating just a little too fast, and my hands are just a little too cold. The fact is, I'm just about 25 years too old to be this scared. We all are. So say something, someone. Let's talk of careers and spouses and what it's like to look at your old playmates and realize that you've taken a few really good shots in the nose from time itself. Let's talk about sex, baseball, the price of gas, the future of the Warsaw Pact nations. Anything but what we came here to talk about. So say something, somebody. Somebody did. Eddie Kasprak did. But it was not what Teddy Kennedy was really like, or how much Redford tipped, or even why he had found it necessary to keep what Richie had sometimes called Eddie's lung sucker in the old days. He asked Mike when Stan Uris had died. "The night before last, when I made the calls." "Did it have to do with why we're here?" "I could beg the question and say that since he didn't leave a note, no one can know for sure," Mike answered. "But since it happened almost immediately after I called him, I think the assumption is safe enough." "He killed himself, didn't he?" Beverly said dully. "Oh, God, poor Stan." The others were looking at Mike, who finished his drink and said, "He committed suicide, yes. Apparently went up to the bathroom shortly after I called him, drew a bath, got into it, and cut his wrists." Bill looked down the table, which seemed suddenly lined with shocked, pale faces. No bodies, only those faces, like white circles. Like white balloons, moon balloons, tethered here by an old promise that should have long since lapsed. "How did you find out?" Richie asked. "Was it carried in the papers up here?" "No. For some time now I've subscribed to the papers of those towns closest to all of you. I have kept tabs over the years." "I spy." Richie's face was sour. "Thanks, Mike." "It was my job," Mike said simply. "Poor Stan," Beverly repeated. She seemed stunned, unable to cope with the news. "But he was so brave back then, so determined." People change, Eddie said.
Do they? Bill asked. Stan was... He moved his hands on the tablecloth, trying to catch the right words. He was an ordered person, the kind of person who has to have his books divided up into fiction and non-fiction on his shelves, and then wants to have each section in alphabetical order. I can remember something he said once. I don't remember where we were or what we were doing, at least not yet, but I think it was toward the end of things. He said he could stand to be scared, but he hated being dirty. That seemed to me the essence of Stan. Maybe it was just too much when Mike called. He saw his choices as being only two. Stay alive and get dirty, or die clean. Maybe people really don't change as much as we think. Maybe they just stiffen up. There was a moment of silence, and then Richie said, All right, Mike, what's happening in Derry? Tell us. I can tell you some, Mike said. I can tell you, for instance, what's happening now, and I can tell you some things about yourselves. But I can't tell you everything that happened back in the summer of 1958, and I don't believe I'll ever have to. Eventually, you'll remember it for yourselves. And I think if I told you too much before your minds were ready to remember, what happened to Stan might happen to us, Ben asked quietly. Mike nodded. Yes, that's exactly what I'm afraid of. Bill said, Then tell us what you can, Mike. All right, he said, I will. 4. The losers get the scoop. The murders have started again, Mike said flatly. He looked up and down the table and then his eyes fixed on Bill's. The first of the new murders, if you'll allow me that rather grisly conceit, began on Main Street Bridge and ended underneath it. The victim was a gay and rather childlike man named Adrian Mellon. He had a bad case of asthma. Eddie's hand stole out and touched the side of his aspirator. It happened last summer on July 21st, the last night of the Canal Days Festival, which was a kind of celebration of... A Derry ritual, Bill said in a low voice. His long fingers were slowly massaging his temples, and it was not hard to guess he was thinking about his brother George. George, who had almost certainly opened the way the last time this had happened. A ritual, Mike said quietly, yes. He told them the story of what had happened to Adrian Mellon quickly, watching with no pleasure as their eyes got bigger and bigger. He told them what the news had reported and what it had not, the latter including the testimony of Dan Haggerty and Christopher Unwin about a certain clown which had been under the bridge like the troll in the fabled story of yore, a clown which had looked like a cross between Ronald McDonald and Bozo, according to Haggerty. It was him, Ben said in a sick, hoarse voice. It was that fucker Pennywise. There's one other thing, Mike said, looking at Bill. One of the investigating officers, the one who actually pulled Adrian Mellon out of the canal, was a town cop named Harold Gardner. Oh, Jesus Christ, Bill said in a weak, teary voice. Bill? Beverly looked at him, then put a hand on his arm. Her voice was full of startled concern. Bill, what's wrong? Harold would have been about 5 then, Bill said. His stunned eyes searched Mike's face for confirmation. Yes. What is it, Bill? Richie asked. Harold Gardner was the son of Dave Gardner, Bill said. Dave lived down the street from us back then, when George was killed. He was the one who got to to my brother first and brought him up to the house, wrapped in a piece of quilt. They sat silently, saying nothing. Beverly put a hand briefly over her eyes. It all fits rather too well, doesn't it? Mike said finally. Yes, Bill said in a low voice. It fits all right. I'd kept tabs on the 6 of you over the years, as I said, Mike went on. But it wasn't until then that I began to understand just why I had been doing it. That it had a real and concrete purpose. Still, I held off, waiting to see how things would develop. You see, I felt that I had to be absolutely sure before I disturbed your lives. Not 90%, not even 95%. 100 was all that would do it. In December of last year, an 8-year-old boy named Stephen Johnson was found dead in Memorial Park. Like Adrian Mellon, he had been badly mutilated just before or just after his death.
but he looked as if he could have died of just plain fright. Sexually assaulted? Eddie asked. No, just plain mutilated. How many in all? Eddie asked, not looking as if he really wanted to know. It's bad, Mike said. How many? Bill repeated. 9 so far. It can't be, Beverly cried. I would have read about it in the paper, seen it on the news. When that crazy cop killed all those women in Castle Rock, Maine, and those children that were murdered in Atlanta. Yes, that, Mike said. I've thought about that a lot. It's really the closest correlative to what's going on here, and Bev's right. That really was coast-to-coast news. In some ways, the Atlanta comparison is the thing about all of this that frightens me the most. The murder of 9 children. We should have TV news correspondents here, and phony psychics, and reporters from the Atlantic Monthly and Rolling Stone. The whole media circus, in short. But it hasn't happened, Bill said. No, Mike answered, it hasn't. Oh, there was a Sunday supplement piece about it in the Portland Sunday Telegram, and another one in the Boston Globe after the last two. A Boston-based television program called Good Day did a segment this February on unsolved murders, and one of the experts mentioned the Derry murders, but only passingly. And he certainly gave no indication of knowing there had been a similar batch of murders in 1957-58, and another in 1929-30. There are some ostensible reasons, of course. Atlanta, New York, Chicago, Detroit, those are big media towns. And in big media towns, when something happens, it makes a bang. There isn't a single TV or radio station in Derry, unless you count the little FM the English and speech department runs up at the high school. Bangor's got the corner on the market when it comes to the media. Except for the Derry News, Eddie said, and they all laughed. But we all know that doesn't really cut it with the way the world is today. The communication web is there, and at some point the story should have broken nationally, but it didn't. And I think the reason is just this. It doesn't want it to. It, Bill mused, almost to himself. It, Mike agreed. If we have to call it something, it might as well be what we used to call it. I've begun to think, you see, that it has been here so long, whatever it really is, that it's become a part of Derry, something as much a part of the town as the standpipe or the canal or Basie Park or the library. Only it's not a matter of outward geography, you understand. Maybe that was true once, but now it's inside. Somehow it's gotten inside. That's the only way I know to understand all of the terrible things that have happened here. The nominally explicable as well as the utterly inexplicable. There was a fire at a Negro nightclub called the Black Spot in 1930. A year before that, a bunch of half-bright Depression outlaws was gunned down on Canal Street in the middle of the afternoon. The Bradley Gang, Bill said. The FBI got them, right? That's what the histories say, but that's not precisely true. So far as I've been able to find out, and I'd give a lot to believe that it wasn't so, because I love this town, the Bradley Gang, all 7 of them, were actually gunned down by the good citizens of Derry. I'll tell you about it sometime. There was the explosion at the Kitchener Ironworks during an Easter egg hunt in 1906. There was a horrible series of animal mutilations that same year that was finally traced to Andrew Rulin, the granduncle of the man who now runs the Rulin Farms. He was apparently bludgeoned to death by the 3 deputies who were supposed to bring him in. None of the deputies were ever brought to trial. Mike Hanlon produced a small notebook from an inner pocket and paged through it, talking without looking up. In 1877, there were 4 lynchings inside the incorporated town limits. One of those that climbed a rope was the lay preacher of the Methodist Church, who apparently drowned all 4 of his children in the bathtub as if they were kittens, and then shot his wife in the head. He put the gun in her hand to make it look like suicide, but no one was fooled. A year before that, 4 loggers were found dead in a cabin downstream on the Kenduskeag, literally torn apart. Disappearances of children, of whole families, are recorded in old diary extracts, but not in any public document. It goes on and on, but perhaps you get the idea. I get the idea, all right, Ben said. Something's going on here, but it's private. Mike closed his notebook, replaced it in his inner pocket, and looked at them soberly. If I were an insurance man instead of a librarian, I'd draw you a graph, maybe.
It would show an unusually high rate of every violent crime we know of, not excluding rape, incest, breaking and entering, auto theft, child abuse, spouse abuse, assault. There's a medium-sized city in Texas where the violent crime rate is far below what you'd expect for a city of its size and mixed racial makeup. The extraordinary placidity of the people who live there has been traced to something in the water, a natural trank of some kind. The exact opposite holds true here. Derry is a violent place to live in an ordinary year. But every 27 years, although the cycle has never been perfectly exact, that violence has escalated to a furious peak, and it has never been national news. "You're saying there's a cancer at work here," Beverly said. "Not at all. An untreated cancer invariably kills. Derry hasn't died. On the contrary, it has thrived. In an unspectacular, unnewsworthy way, of course. It is simply a fairly prosperous, small city in a relatively unpopulous state where bad things happen too often, and where ferocious things happen every quarter of a century or so." "That holds true all down the line?" Ben asked. Mike nodded. "All down the line, 1715-16, 1740 until roughly 1743, that must have been a bad one, 1769-70, and on, right up to the present time."